this group may be, are at the bottom of the economic ladder, and they are confined into any particular area, that area does. And when credit is withheld from them, when they are the last to be hired and the first to be fired, the community in which they live are going to deteriorate. That is what has happened in Harlem. However, today, we do see a terrific change with the Negro and Puerto Rican given greater opportunities in employment, the privilege of living any place they wish, a change for the better in the Harlem community, Harlem communities. I say Harlem communities, we have Harlem here, East Bronx, Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn, South Jamaica in Jamaica. They're all similar type areas. Now, we have noticed a terrific upsurge for the better. There are more businesses being owned by the inhabitants. There are fewer absentee landlords and business owners. There is the people that inhabit the communities are making more money. And consequently, they are putting more back into the properties. They are able to live better, and they are able to make a better community. I'll answer your questions.
Yes, thank you. Any further questions? Well, we certainly appreciate your giving us of your valuable time, and in a short time, we certainly learned a lot.
Well, thank you so much. I don't know. I have a coin here, one of the two coins that has the face of a Negro on it. This is an American 50 cents piece. I don't know if how many of you have seen it. I'd like for you to. There's two Negroes on this, Booker T. Washington and George Washington Carver. That's a 50 cents, an American 50 cents piece.
When was that coin?
You can. Frankly, it's worth more than 50 cents. It's become a collector's item. This was coined in 48, I believe. 52. This is a short map. It's a 50 cents piece. I don't know if each one of you can see. It's there. But today it's worth about $3.50 because of the scarcity of it. Booker T. Washington.
It'd be interesting to know just how that came to be coined and why more weren't.
As I understand, they are building a foundation in a little town out in Virginia. So the government permitted the mint to print, make a certain number of these coins in order to help to build this foundation. And when they came out, they were sold at a premium of 60 cents instead of 50 cents. However, since there were so few of them, coin collectors and people all over the world seek them. They will pay at least $3.50 to $5 for this now. it's an American 50 cents piece. Did you see it here?
Yeah.
See, there is it.
I got that to show.
We bought about 4,000 of them, and we only have fewer than 100 left.
So what you doing?
Well, in the beginning, we sold them for 60 cents. Now we saved them. We're just saving these for posterity. Well, there are a few people that have them, and but I don't think you'll find them in circulation very often. You may look for it since you know what it is.
If a person brings one to you, will you give him $3.50?
No, we would give him the original premium of 10 cents if he asked for it, but we would suggest that he go to a coin collector. See, we're not coin collectors, and he would get more money.
thank you very much, Mr. Davis. Very interesting business, question was.
I always speak for next year, but I might have another eighth grade next year.
Well, thank you. We'll be happy to see you. The eighth graders are not too large for lollipops. Give them a lot to you there.
His office. Yes. His office has a like an air vent to the top glass window, which you cannot see through. He has a couch and a matching chair and three other like table set chairs. We're leaving the bank now. I don't know where we're going. They changed their plans and we're going upstairs and upstairs in the bank. The stairs have the same color carpet on them as the floor.
We're just preparing now for a broadcast over WHBI today at 1 o'clock from 1 until 2 o'clock.
The stairs are very nice. Fancy stairs. And upstairs is a lot of little offices.
These are regular offices, machine rooms, the auditor, the general counsel. And this room here is the board of directors room, also where we negotiate and transact business concerning to mortgages.
Seems like the board of directors are having a meeting now, and there's only one white person in there. They have the men's room and the women's room up here.
This is the lounge room for our employers, and they walk in and look around.
They have a lounge room for the employees, and it's very nice. It has a clock in it. With a radio, three tables with relaxing chairs. Even has a kitchen like in here. And excuse me, table cutters on, excuse me.
Employees, you coming out?
And there's another room over here. What did you say that room was?
I'm sorry. And this on the left is our mortgage.
This is the mortgage room. It has two maps. One map seems to be of Brooklyn and one map of Manhattan. And they have dots. I guess the dots mean of people who they loan to and that's where they live. Three desks. And the one thing about the bank, they seem to like the color yellow because the most of the bank is in yellow. Now we're on Lakes Avenue on 121st Street. We're at Frederick Douglass Book Center, but the man does not seem to be there. We're going to the Peddlers Union now. Because the guys didn't get there enough to be a green Allen Peddler. The union now, we're going up. Our elevator is blue. This is my third floor. It's right next to a bank. Looks like the bank, it has a cashier, receptionist sort of thing. It's a blackboard with stickers and stuff. Register for unemployment. And it also shows a COPE award for good citizenship given to the union. And it's part of the AFL-CIO. This too has an auditorium. In the auditorium, I have a picture of the Pullman and two conventions. And I have a picture of famous people and stuff like that. I appreciate it. Thank you. And I hope it has a stage with, if you have a board of directors here, it has a stage for that. It has a flag of the United States of America flag. They seem to have their own flag. It's blue and gold. But as I said before, on the stage you have space for the board of the chairman. They have a picture of A. Philip Randolph.
Let me give you,
I think he's the head or something.
Just a little bit of brief background which will help you understand, I think, a little bit. The Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters is a union that's composed, I think, almost 100% Negroes. The other railway unions, there are a whole group of railway unions, the engineers, the conductors, the brakemen, they're all there. Each one has its own separate union, but they're all part of the railway union.
Now, these other unions have discriminated over the years so that they are all white. And the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters is also. And this is the situation within this particular industry. Well, Mr. Randolph, of course, is the head of the union, and he has, I don't know too much about it, but I know he's associated with it from the very early days. He's sort of a pioneer in building up the union. We're not going to see him, but we're going to see Mr. McLaurin, whose name I know has been associated with the union. This is the banner of the union, you know, when they go in parade.
It's blue and gold. It has Latin on it. Labor Obrera Vincit.
Labor
Conquers All. Which means Labor Conquers All. And on his forward to victory, never say die. Fight or be slaves. It is the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. Here comes our speaker. Get the speaker.
Well, if you'll get your
notebook,
please. I'm terribly sorry. We came in much later than we're supposed to, and we're here now.
I'm delighted indeed that you could come to us. It's my understanding that you are attempting to learn something about the community in which we live and work. The Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters is not just another trade union. It is a trade union that looks after the problems of its members, but we also try to make our activities tie in with the needs of the community. And the reason for this is the fact that our members live in the community. And we are not interested in giving them a high standard of living at the expense of the other citizens. We therefore feel that it would be of little cost while everybody else in the community had a very low standard. Because we realized that in the long run, the people with a low standard would pull down the standard of the Brotherhood members. Therefore, we have a history of cooperating with the civil rights movements in the nation. First, I'd like to tell you something about our brotherhood, the nature of our work, the construction of our organization, something about the position of the porters when we got started back in 1925. In 1925, we had in Pullman service a company union. Now, a company union is an organization paid for, controlled, and directed by the company. It decides the wages you are going to receive, the hours of work, and the conditions under which you work. Now, Pullman porters are the people who make beds on Pullman cars. These are cars operated on the trains where people sleep and enjoy a good night's rest. I suppose some of you have seen a Pullman car. Any of you had a ride on a Pullman car yet? Well, then you know what I'm talking about. In addition to representing the sleeping car porters, the Brotherhood represents train porters. And
These are the people who work on coaches. They keep the coaches clean and help the conductors get tickets and things of that kind. And then we represent attendants. These are the people who operate on the streamlined coaches. It's a super deluxe coach, where you have the reclining seats, where you pay a little more than you would pay on the ordinary train. Now in 1925, the salary of a porter, this represents all the porters, whether he was a Pullman porter, a train porter, or a sleeping car, the average porter at that time received $67.50 per month. The average hours the porters were called upon to work, the average hour the porters were called upon to work in 1925 was 400. Some men made 500 hours. Others may have made 350, but the average number of men, the hours a man worked was 400. For those hours of work, he got $67.50. $400 of work, you got $67.50. Now, a porter can get fired for almost anything. If a passenger decided that the porter did not give her the kind of services she was entitled to, she would report him to the superintendent, and he was subject to be fired. We had a very unusual case where a superintendent's wife in Denver, Colorado came down to the training one morning and saw a porter who, in her opinion, looked like a Chinaman and reported that he was not the type of individual that ought to remain on a porter car. That man was fired. This is the nature of our struggle. When the Brotherhood got started back in 1925, the Pullman Company said to the porters that they had no rights, and they did everything they possibly could do to show these porters they had no rights, because between 1925 and 1937, when we wrote our first contract, more than 500 Pullman porters lost their jobs. One reason or another. Because you must remember that the company union gave the company all the rights. The company union had a grievance committee, and they had five members on the grievance committee. But one superintendent had more power than all five of the men on the committee. Therefore, the superintendent had the right to determine whether or not a porter was guilty as charged. And nine times out of ten, his decision stood. The company tried in every way they could to stop the porters from organizing an independent union. They came to the Negro communities and they enlisted the support of the preachers. They had most of the agencies in the community supporting the company plan, and it was a very simple method. The Brotherhood of Central Car Porters had no money, and the ministers were interested in contributions, and so the Pullman Company could contribute to the rallies they had for fun. As in the case of the YMCA, they made an annual contribution to the YM and the YWCA. These institutions, while in our community, would not even permit us the opportunity of holding a meeting, because the Pullman Company may stop their contributions, and they were not interested in the organization of the porters at the expense of the contributions the company had made. They couldn't foresee that if the porters got a decent salary, that they would be in a position to get many more contributions from the porters who lived in the community and could utilize the Y.
There was only one church in a big city like New York where the porters got a welcome for me. And this church was a Presbyterian church under the direction of a man by the name of William Lloyd Hines. He's now retired, but he was a steady, loyal, devoted friend to the cause of organized slavery. Tell me how long you're going to stay with him, Arthur?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, from 1925 to 1937, we were busy attempting to carry on agitation for the organization of an independent organization among the voters. We had no laws that protected our We did not come under the Railway Labor Act, where most of the white workers got protection. We did not come under the Addison 8-hour day that gave the white workers the benefit of an 8-hour day in the railway industry. It required, therefore, a lot of activity on the part of the Brotherhood to get the Railway Labor Act amended to include the posters. And so in 1934, we finally got Congress to make an amendment to the Railway Labor Act, giving postmen, porters, and dining car employees protection under the Act, and made it impossible for the company to continue to use the company union to the disadvantage of the organization of the porters. And so we had an eruption in the ranks of postmen, porters, where the porters were given a free choice to decide whether or not they wanted to remain in the company union or have an independent organization of their own. In 1935, we won the right of representation. We won with 94% of the porters voting for independent organization. It was a surprising vote for the Pullman Company, because they had every reason to believe that they really understood the Pullman. They boasted about their knowledge of the Negro and how well they knew him. As a matter of fact, in the early days, they hired President Lincoln's son as the first president of Pullman in order that they could attract certain types of voters to come in Pullman service. You see, this was a real advantage, because over the years, Pullman's Negroes had been in slavery and they had not been given an opportunity for a decent job. And coming on a railroad, getting an opportunity to get out of bad weather and be assured of some type of living, they were so certain that the love of the Negro for the company would remain forever. But as I said, they got in our way when we won the right of representation. After we won the right of representation, then we decided negotiating a contract with the Pullman Company. It required 2 years to get our first contract. 2 years of constant negotiation. But in our first contract, we got an increase of $12. This was the largest increase that porters had ever received. Prior to the coming of the Brotherhood, no Negro in the railway industry ever received as much as $100 in actual pay. No Negro. When the pension law was passed in 1937, that gave the average worker a $100 pension, the salaries of porters were so low that they couldn't get $50. Because you must remember that at one time they worked for $12 a month. And in 1925, they had only been able to get their salaries up to $67. And your pensions were based on your earnings for 30 years. pensions were around $35, $37. Congress passed a special regulation making it possible for these men to get a minute or $50. Now, from 1925 until this day, the organization has revolutionized Pullman service. The average Pullman today receives in salary $432. This is the average Pullman. Some men are making a great deal more, but the average salary of a Pullman today is $432 per month. Always a month. We work at the fair for a month. But we have reduced the hours from 400 to 205. He makes 205 hours a day. We are now in the process of reducing his hours of work. We have petitioned our government. Not get it through negotiation. He would give us a 40-hour work week. As a matter of fact, the country today is fighting for a 35-hour work week. We have presently a 48-hour work week. We are now in session with the railroad companies of the country in Chicago this very day, attempting to reduce our hours of work. That we find it difficult to live with. They have recommended that the hours be reduced from 48 hours a month, from 205 hours a month, to 195 hours. And that 2.5 years from now, that we be allowed to work on 180 hours a month. We are in the real sense of the word. other problems that affect the American workers. For instance, in 1941, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters spearheaded the March on Washington movement that gave this country the first fair employment practice law. This was a law that made it possible for Negroes and other minorities to find work in industry that were denied them prior to this executive order issued by President Roosevelt, the late President Roosevelt. We organized thousands of workers, and we were planning to descend on Washington because the president and all our good white friends in the country did not want a large demonstration in Washington. As a matter of fact, Mrs. Roosevelt and Mayor Gardner and all the other politicians and good friends did everything they could to stop the march. But we could not stop the march because we said to our friends, you don't know what it is to be denied a job that you can do simply because you happen to be colored. You don't know what it is to try to get in the army and find yourself segregated in the army or the navy because of color. You don't know what it is to be told that you must pay much more rent for a given apartment because you are forced to live in a ghetto and your rent must be higher because of color, and yet you deny the job and you can't find sufficient money to meet these high standards of living. We had a situation where we had discrimination in the trade union. We had discrimination in the government. Almost everybody that you could turn could not get employment. During the war, this was during the war, there was a need for a lot of employees. Jobs were going begging, but they were not giving the Negro the opportunity to acquire the job. You had a situation where you would go to a factory to get a job. This would be a union factory. And the union would say to the worker, I would give you the job, but you've got to get a car. Now the union controlled the car, and he was not going to give the union the Negro this car. He'd go back to management, and management would say to him, well, I'd like to hire you, but you've got to get your car from the union. You found yourself caught between the vices. You couldn't get the job because you didn't have the car, and you couldn't get the car because you couldn't join the union. And so you were denied the job. This is why we had the fight for fair employment practices. Today you have a large number of cities, 24, 25 cities, with fair employment practice regulations. Most of them stem from this activity. Very recently, we were engaged in the largest demonstration I've never seen it. The 28th day of August, we carried better than 200,000 people to Washington. This march was the result of all faiths, all the trade unions, many of the government workers, everybody concerned with civil rights, came to Washington fighting for equality of the Negro workers. We had the cooperation of our government at this time, and we didn't have the same kind of thing we had back in 1941 with the government. We're trying to stop you from coming to Washington. Now, the U.S. demonstration was not necessarily a demonstration for jobs. It was a demonstration for jobs, freedom, for justice. It was a demonstration to show to America that the Negroes had become of age, that we were mature, that we were responsible, that we felt that we had every right to demand all the privileges that other people had in America. In short, we were trying to change the image of the Negro in the minds of white America. And while they expected that there would be a lot of violence, a lot of people would be in opposition to the law, and there would be a lot of pushing around by the police, in spite of the fact that we had over 200,000 people in Washington at the Lincoln Monument, we had absolutely no demonstrations that indicated violence, indicated any creeping mistrust, or anything to indicate that there was anything but a lack of harmony and goodwill. By the fact that you had 30% of the demonstrators from the white community. Now, today, we are in a real struggle for survival. We are seeking equality in every avenue of America's life. You perhaps are aware that we've just lost our president because too many people had the idea that he was pushing too hard, too fast in this field of equality for the Negro. And you had a great deal of unrest because you had major demonstrations in our city for jobs, for opportunity, for tradition. The Brothers and Sleeping Car Voters has been in the forefront of most of these demonstrations. We are affiliated with the American Federation of Labor, CIO. And of course, I think you are aware that just 5 years ago, Mr. Randolph in the Denver Convention had a tilt with Mr. George Meany, who is president of the AFL-CIO, Mr. Randolph, president of the Brotherhood of Labor Conference. At that time, we were demanding that trade unions affiliated with the AFL-CIO that discriminate against Negroes ought to be put out of the Federation. The charters ought to be taken up. We took the position that if you can take a charter from an organization that discriminates, that is guilty of communist leanings, if you are guilty of racketeering, such as has been expressed in the Teamsters Union, where they have put half of the organization out because they're supposed to benefit from racketeering, we say that if you put organizations out because of communist meetings or racketeering, then you ought to be able to put them out from discriminating against other workers. Mr. Randolph, the meeting wanted to know who gave Mr. Randolph the right to speak for the Negro workers. Well, I think Mr. Meany got his answer, because in the next convention that was held in Miami, a large number of Negro delegates waited on Mr. Meany and told him that they resented his remarks and his attitude toward Mr. Randolph. In addition, he created a desire on the part of Negroes to get together to protect their own interests and welfare. And we have set in motion a committee known as the National Council for the National Negro American Council. This council is an organization of Negro trade unionists that does nothing but function in the field of the trade unions to try and find avenues of employment, to open avenues of training, to deal with the various questions of discrimination. Now, 2 years ago, Mr. Meany's executive council censored Brother Randolph. That is, they told him he was wrong and he would have to retract certain statements before he would really be in good repute with his co-workers. Mr. Randolph refused to accept that position. And so given the opportunity of leading the discussion, and the Federation itself went on record with the strongest civil rights revolution resolution that we've had since we've had an NPL-style organization. Now, I think I have given you a long, short, and in such minutes as I have, I hope you have a similar thing.